Welcome to the AmeriChicks with Kim Monson and Molly Vogt. Molly is a former mutual fund consultant and retirement plan specialist who is currently the director and founder of My Purse Politics. Kim served as a city councilwoman, is a former investment broker, and now a successful entrepreneur. Now, let's hear what's hatching in local and national politics with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim.
Hey, welcome to the AmeriChicks. Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. I'm Kim Munson.
I am Molly Vogt.
And it is Friday. We hope you are having a fabulous Friday.
Yes, we sure do. Yeah. And it's World War II Day. We're going to have a very special story for you today. We're going to talk to somebody who actually was a prisoner of war during the war. And I think back, Kimmy, and I'm like, oh, I can't wait for Friday. I can't wait for the weekend. I'm having a bad week, or I'm just having a stressful day. I got to stop and think, these people, like Bill Funk, that we're going to talk to today, who lived through just, torture and hunger and freezing times and just was so scared for his life all the time. You got to come back and think, you know what? My life's not that bad, and be grateful and be thankful. And that's one of the reasons that I'm so happy, Kim, that we get to do this World War II project in all of our shows here, check out our shows at AmeriChicks.com. But we want to share real life stories of real life people and make sure that people know, you know what, if that person can survive, I can survive. I can keep going. Never give up.
Well, yes, in the words of Winston Churchill, never, never, never give up. You know, these World War II shows precipitated out of a 2016 trip that you and I took with the Denver Police Activities League that accompanied four D-Day vets back to Normandy. And when we returned, we realized that these stories really, really needed to be shared. And, you know, we call them the greatest generation, and they are a great generation. I've thought about it. You know, they stand on the shoulders of the soldiers of the Civil War, the Revolutionary War. We stand on the shoulders of these giants. And like you mentioned, we need to realize the sacrifice that they made, and we need to respect it. And these stories with these guys are truly changing my life. So people can get these stories, as you mentioned, at AmeriChicks.com. All these stories are archived there, and you can certainly share those with friends and family. And so we have Bill Funk on the line. And, Bill, thank you for joining the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Molly.
Well, we sure.
Am I talking to Molly or Kim?
Well, you're talking to both
of us. You're talking to both of us now.
Incidentally, my name is pronounced Funky.
Oh, is it? Okay. I apologize.
That's what I thought.
Okay.
That's what Molly thought.
Well, you know what? I thought I asked you. So, Bill Funky, thank you
really
so much
cool
for
name.
Clarifying that. Mm-hmm. So,
that's right.
So, Bill, real quick question. As I was doing some research, and we know that you are a prisoner of war in Stalag 11B, and we're gonna talk about that today. I was going through the names and searching, and I saw that there was another William Funky also at that same camp, and I'm wondering if it's any relation or if you know who William H. Funky Jr. is.
I have no idea. I didn't know there was one.
Okay.
Huh. You've told me something new, but I think it must be just a duplication of names, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, there are 1,300 prisoners there, so yeah. a
right.
lot of names coming and going, I'm sure.
Right.
So, well, Bill, let's start at the beginning. Where were you when you heard that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story. I was in high school. I was a junior at the time, and I was playing in an all-state band in Kansas. I was a Kansas native.
And me too.
The concert was going on that very Sunday. And the people who were running the concert, which is an all-state concert, were wise enough to not announce it during the concert. They waited till it was over, and I always bless them for that. But I was 80 miles, no, mile, about 120 miles from home. I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, and I wasn't sure I was going to get home. But that was it. I was in an all-state band playing a concert at the time.
How old were you at that time?
Well, I was a junior in high school. I would have been 17.
Okay.
And, Bill, what were you playing in the band? What's your instrument?
My instrument then was clarinet.
Okay.
I played the clarinet, too.
I did, too, but only for a couple weeks. I wasn't that good.
That won't get it.
So, Bill, you graduated from high school. What happened after that?
at that time, you could volunteer induction. We all knew where we were going to go. But a lot of the seniors at that time tended to volunteer induction. But the day after Pearl Harbor, the senior boys were all going to leave school and go, but they got them all together and told them to wait until their graduation and then go and be drafted. We knew at my age, we knew we were going to be drafted, but instead of waiting, most of us went into volunteer induction. So we went in a little earlier than we needed to, but at that time, that was the thing to do. It was not a chore to go. It was a desire to go.
Now, had you graduated from high school, Bill?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then you did volunteer induction.
And what did your parents think about that?
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. What did your parents think about that, Bill? Were they okay with the fact that you wanted to join the military?
Yes. Yes, they were. They were. They knew it was coming, and they felt the same way. Why start something and then be uprooted from it?
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So you joined the Army, right?
Right.
And so for a Kansas kid, you joined the Army. Where did you go to boot camp?
Boot camp was in Camp Roberts, California. I was inducted at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas because I was in eastern Kansas where I live. But my early training, my basic training was in Camp Roberts, California, as in artillery. And let's see, I can't remember. Well, yes, I do it. Our training was 16 weeks long and very, very thorough. And that was the first camp I attended.
But was it what you thought it was going to be, boot camp, or were there any kind of changes or shocks or surprises?
No. There wasn't any surprise. I knew it was going to be tough.
Yeah.
I was not prepared for the heat for that part of the country in California. Hmm. But there was no shock. I knew it was going to be difficult, but it was just part of life. And I think everybody there just kind of took it because it was there.
Okay, so once you completed basic training, Bill Funky, where did you go after that?
Well, there was a program called ASTP, the Army Specialized Training Program. It was like the Navy V-12. Program, which was very, very successful. The Army's ASTP training was not successful. It was hastily thrown together and not too well handled. I went to a junior college in Santa Rosa, California, and was sent to a New Mexico A&M in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And that was about the time they decided they needed more people on the front lines than they needed doctors and engineers. Oh, right, by the way, that's what they were going to do with us, make doctors and engineers out of all us, which was really, again, I say not very well thought out. So they closed that program and shipped us all the ASTP men into different units around the country. And mine happened to be the 12th Armored Division, which at that time was stationed in Abilene, Texas.
Okay, and so you join the 12th Armored Division. You end up in Europe, right? How do you get from Texas to Europe?
Well, we shipped by train to Camp Shanks, New York. And that was in, we went in January, late January, we went to Camp Barkley, Texas, and then we shipped into Camp Shanks in October, and we went overseas in early October.
And what year was that, Bill Funky?
Let me think. That'd be 1944.
Okay, so that was after D-Day then.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was after D-Day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we went to England and did some more training there.
Okay.
And then eventually they were sent across the channel to Le Havre. Le Havre was kind of a staging center for every unit entering Europe from that northern position.
And you, at this particular point in time, you've not seen any combat or any battle yet, right?
No,
you're still this a kid with training from Kansas, from eastern Kansas. So
that's right. not until then.
Okay.
And then we, well, we really didn't see any until we had crossed, crossed France and went through down through the eastern and southern part, so we didn't get up in the northern part of France where the fighting was going on, but they're trying to bolster the southern area. And so we went into the Alsace area of France.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out then in the time, that was October, you said, of 44, mm-hmm. and you go into the southern, there were actually, in southern France, there was a second Battle of the Bulge that people don't really talk that much about. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks of the one in the northern, but were you involved in the one that's called the Southern
yes.
Battle of the Bulge?
Yes, we were. And that was the, there was a southern invasion from Italy. There was a big invasion in southern France around Nice and down in that area. But this second bulge that is not very much written about in history, although you can find it now in different books, took place north of Strasbourg, France. And at that time it was designed supposedly to split the France and retake part of southern France and to meet them coming up from southern France. So they established a bridgehead up there, and the people who were in always called it the Second Battle of the Bulge.
You know, hey, Bill, let's hold that.
Little written about it.
Let's hold that thought. We're going to go to break, and okay. when we come back, let's go ahead and start talking a little bit more about this Second Battle of the Bulge.
If you're a veteran looking to purchase a home, choose the local experts, Kim Sturtz and Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance. VA loans offer qualifying veterans the option to buy without a down payment. And since these loans are government insured, limited closing fees. Active duty military, reserves, National Guard, retired military, and surviving spouses may qualify. Give Kim Sturtz or Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance a call today at 303-888-2732. Or check them out on the AmeriChicks referral list at AmeriChicks.com. Home Mortgage Alliance LLC is an approved FHA lender and sponsored agent of VA loans. NMLS number 1137507.
When buying or selling your home, you need a top-notch negotiator with experience. Award-winning RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine has helped individuals navigate the ups and downs of the Denver real estate market for over 25 years. Karen Levine is honest, trustworthy, and has your best interests in mind. Let Karen help you find the right home for your lifestyle. Call Karen at 303-877-7516 for a no-cost consultation. That's 303-877-7516 or visit her online at Karen-Levine.com and tell her the AmeriChicks sent you. Bookkeeping, accounting, and taxes, oh my! No need to worry about your company or personal finances with the proven professionals at Predovich & Company. Predovich & Company are certified public accountants who offer exceptional services to individuals, businesses, and nonprofits. Serving the South Metro area, the team at Predovich & Company strives to take a proactive approach in understanding your tax, accounting, and bookkeeping needs and situation. Give Predovich & Company a call at 303-791-3000 or check out their website at dpredovich.com and be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
In a world of uncertainty, anything can happen. It pays to protect yourself, your family, your business, your home, and your car. And it pays to work with the proven professionals at Alliance Insurance Services. Jeremy McCallum and his Alliance Insurance Services team work with a variety of insurance companies competing for your business. Jeremy and the Alliance Insurance Services team helps you find the right insurance at the right price. They know you'll sleep better at night knowing Alliance Insurance Services is handling all of your insurance needs. Give them a call today at 303-431-9351. That's 303-431-9351. And be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. It is World War II Project Day. We are excited to be talking with Bill Funke. Bill grew up in eastern Kansas. He joined the Army in, was it 1943 that you joined, Bill?
43,
okay. And you served, is it Company A of the 17th Armored Infantry Battalion of the 12th Armored Division?
That's correct.
Okay. You know what? It is in Brad Hoop's book, Reflections of Our Gentle Warriors. And so we know if it says it there, that it's absolutely correct. And in fact, Bill Funke, that's how we found you, was through Brad Hoops, who's written this beautiful book. We recommend it to everyone. It's Reflections of Our Gentle Warriors. And it's stories, I think it's 70 different stories of guys and gals that served in World War II. It is absolutely a beautiful piece of work. So you are highlighted there under recurring thoughts, Bill Funke.
Well, you And anybody who has not met Brad Hoops has missed part of their life.
We agree. We agree. So, Bill Funke, before we went to break, we were talking about the Southern Battle of the Bulge. And a lot of people had never heard of it. And what had happened, or my understanding, is the Northern Battle of the Bulge, is it was a very cold winter. And many of our commanders thought that, you know, the fighting might kind of lay low during that particular time. And Hitler decided that he wanted to make a kind of a go of it. He wanted to attack and went on the aggression. And so that happened up there. But it also happened in the south, in France, near Strasbourg. And that's where you were.
That's right. It was also a diversion from the northern attack that they had mounted. And the interesting thing about that cold, we were not prepared for the cold because our upper echelon brass in both of the armies figured that the war would be over by Christmas before the cold weather set in. And so we were completely unprepared for the cold. We would, if we could find blankets or something, we'd cut them and try to sew them inside our jackets. More warmth, and we had leather shoes, which was wrong because we lost many, many men because of frozen feet and didn't get the regular cold weather shoe packs until late in December. And so that all played a part in what happened to the soldiers, just not in the front, but also in the south. And
it was like a 100-year winter there.
Well, we heard 50.
Oh, did you hear 50? Okay.
It was cold enough.
Yeah. Give or take 50 years, it was cold, wasn't it?
Well, and then they just got a bridgehead across that Rhine, and that's the northern, about 20 miles north of Strasbourg where they came across. And for some reason, someone wasn't looking. They got more people across than they had imagined. And that was the problem. That's why it blew up and exploded and took so many men. And I think the reason we didn't read about it is, I understand General Patch, who I think was one of the greatest generals in World War II, and General Devers did not like photographers. They didn't like newspaper men. And they would just almost keep them out of the area. So there was nothing to write about.
Now, Bill, did you say General Patch or General Patton?
Patch.
Okay.
Patton was in the Third Army up north.
Okay.
And he was interested in publicity. And his whole personality was that way. But there were just two different generals. They're both fine generals, but we thought that General Patch was handling things well as they came across.
Okay, so you're in France. You're thinking that the war is going to be over soon. When did you realize that you were under attack and that things were not working out the way everybody had initially thought?
Well, let me think a minute. That would have been about the 1st of January. Different units from the armored division, the whole division, began making contact, and they found out that it was not going to be easy. It was a very strange thing. When we went in and we were not, I'll get to that a little bit later, but actually at the time of my capture and the time we lost so many men from the 17th Battalion, we were under the control of the French. The other thing that most people don't understand, that de Gaulle and Eisenhower had a running battle from day one. And Eisenhower wanted to draw those lines of the 7th Army. We were in part of the 7th Army. Wanted to draw them back to solidify them. When the French took control, they said, no way are we going to give up any land that we have taken. And so they insisted we stay there. So actually, we were under the French right at the time my group was captured, or the people from my group were captured.
Well, your commanding officer had requested to retreat, correct?
Oh, yes, yes. At that time, I was a runner for Captain Helton, for our company commander. All the battalions were under attack, and all the companies are under attack, but I can only speak for my A company. And I was a runner for the battalion commander, Major Logan, at the time, and three times that day, once we got in, I have to back up a little bit. We were told that there were probably 300 infantrymen in this town of Herrlichheim that they wanted us to clear out. Excuse me. But when we got in, we found out that there was an SS tank division
of
11,000 men in that area.
You said 1,000 men?
11,000.
11,000.
And they had a whole division, yeah. And obviously, we knew exactly. When we got into the town, we knew what had happened. And our battalion commander, Major Logan, again, as I was his runner, and a runner just simply is a man, if the radio communication breaks down, the runner delivers messages from the commanders to the post that he wants to contact. And so he knew, and we knew, as runners, we knew what was happening. And he was told, and he requested three times, once in the early afternoon, once in the early evening, and once at about 10:30 at night, I guess it was, to withdraw what was left of the company. But they were told not to. And most of the men wondered why. Our officers who could see that, and our commanding officers knew what was going on, why we were not allowed out. But at that time, we had just gone over to French control, and they were the ones that were in command at the time. They said no withdrawal. So that's what resulted. It was not very nice.
Well, Bill, I want to ask you about being a runner. First of all, you know, you probably were fast and in pretty good shape would be my guess, but that seems like that's somebody that the Germans would probably want to shoot at.
Well, you know, I always felt that another friend of mine that was a runner, too, and I never talked to him about this. I was always going to, but I always felt that they were letting me through, and they were not shooting at me because they wanted to know where those posts were, and I always kind of felt that.
Well, that makes sense.
Bill,
that was individual soldiers. The artillery was coming in all the time, and you're kind of... We weren't dodging it, but if you'd hear it coming, or hear an explosion, you'd figure next one is coming someplace. It was kind of a lonely job because you're by yourself, and
you also know what's going on. So that
we knew what was going on, and we'd report back to the battalion what was happening, and his final report was to find these individual posts. It'd be maybe a squad of men, or maybe two squads of men in a certain area, and just tell them the orders were to draw back toward the command post. And so that was the runner's work. And that wasn't just me. It was the other runners in other groups were suffering the same things. And so we knew pretty much what was happening.
How far were you running between posts?
Oh, goodness. Well, sometimes it was a matter of yards. Sometimes it was maybe a half mile. Or three quarters of a mile, but it felt like a lot longer than that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it did.
Bill Funky, this may be a totally silly question, but were you afraid?
You know, I've been asked that before. It's either too stupid to be afraid or too cold to be afraid. I never felt a fear that I couldn't do what I was supposed to do. I never had that feeling, but that is a question I thought about because there are times I should have been.
Yeah,
and we all were afraid. We were all afraid.
Sure.
But it wasn't a paralyzing type fear.
Yeah. Well, and the sad thing is that you had such bad intelligence about the number of men that you were going to be fighting against. It seems like it was the same with Iwo Jima. They just thought that it was going to be so easy. So tell us what happened when this attack started.
Well, when we started, we started 2 days before, and we got caught out in an open field, and the tank, there was a crust on the ground, and the tanks would break through, and they were just like sitting ducks in a gallery, I mean, they were just pecking off our tanks. So we lost our tank battalions. That was, we had no tank support in the town because they had all been either blown up out in that field, because we watched them. We were just out in the field with them, and we'd just see them being picked off. And so our numbers were down. Actually, we're down already when we went into the town. So,
well, and when you said 11,000 SS, our understanding is the SS, they were different than just the regular German soldier. They were not very nice guys.
They were the highly trained, and they fought well.
Yeah.
They fought well. They were so highly trained. You know, that's right. They did have a thing, though, that I thought was kind of interesting. When the war was over and they talked about it, and we had a couple of friends who went back and met with some of their commanders. And, as a matter of fact, there's a book out now called Something on the Rhine, not on the Rhine, the Zorn, Crossing the Zorn. It's a story of that battle. And at that time, they had dubbed the 12th Armored Division the Suicide Division, because they just kept throwing men in, you know. And we were credited with blunting that that attack. And so it wasn't lost, but we wondered about some things.
Well, and we're talking with Bill Funke. He is a World War II veteran, Army. He was in the Southern Battle of the Bulge down near Strasbourg, France. And we're talking a little bit about this battle that you were involved in. And you said out of the 320 men who started out, approximately 35 were left. So, Bill Funke, we're going to go to break. This is the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt, and Kim Munson. And when we come back, we want to hear what happened you 35 had survived. So this is the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We'll be right back.
Guy Whidden, 101st Airborne, landed Normandy in the dark on D-Day 1944, was knocked out on the jump, woke up, a gun to his head. What happened next? If you love the AmeriChicks World War II project on Fridays and know a World War II vet, we'd love to share their story. We're in a race against time to gather as many stories as possible and as quickly as possible to preserve them for all future generations. So if you know a World War II vet or have that great World War II story to share, email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. That's the AmeriChicks@gmail.com.
If you're a veteran looking to purchase a home, choose the local experts, Kim Sturtz and Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance. VA loans offer qualifying veterans the option to buy without a down payment. And since these loans are government insured, limited closing fees. Active duty military, reserves, National Guard, retired military, and surviving spouses may qualify. Give Kim Sturtz or Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance a call today at 303-888-2732. Or check them out on the AmeriChicks referral list at AmeriChicks.com. Home Mortgage Alliance LLC is an approved FHA lender and sponsored agent of VA loans. NMLS number 1137507.
Hello, friends. This is Jeff Hunt, director of the Centennial Institute, and I am so excited for the events we're hosting in 2018. You know, our mission is to provide a bold, conservative voice in Colorado. We host a lot of events, inviting the country's top conservative leaders to our state. This includes the chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom on January 29th at Colorado Christian University. In February, we'll be hosting a panel discussion with Colorado State Treasurer candidates, as well as an event with the author of George Washington's Sacred Fire about the faith of George Washington. In April, we're hosting Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, one of the top thinkers on transgender issues. I hope you'll join us for these important events. You can find more details about these events and other events we're hosting at centennial.events. That's centennial.events. In 2018, let's usher in a conservative revolution in Colorado.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks show, Molly and Kim. It is World War II Project Day, and we're excited to have a very special story to share with you right now. I cannot imagine being a prisoner of war in any war, and I can't imagine how it is that Bill Funke survived. But he is here to tell the tale, and he's on with us right now. Bill Funke, thank you so much for joining us today. So real quick, in case anybody just tuned in, during the Second World War, you served in Company A of the 17th Armored Infantry Battalion of the 12th Armored Division. And in January of 1945, your battalion was fighting the Germans in northeastern France. Your position was overrun. Of the approximately 320 men who moved forward to attack, only 35 survived, including you. You were taken prisoner, and so let's talk about that attack, if you don't mind. Start with the attack, what happened, and then what happened when you became prisoner.
Okay. I may have misled you on that when I think survived. I mean, either killed or wounded. Mm-hmm. I mean, out of that group, they weren't all killed. They were taken back earlier during the attack, could have been back. So that number was higher than that. And it was not the whole battalion. It was just my company.
Okay.
And so that was a little misleading on the numbers.
Okay.
But the attack was just simply to clear out this town. And when we got in there, we found it couldn't be done. We had a tank division in there and some other infantrymen, and were overwhelmed. But the main thing was that we were not allowed to go out. We knew that by morning. We knew it by 10 o'clock that morning, because that was when the major's first call was, we know what we found what we thought might be here and that we can't handle it. We need to withdraw, and they were not allowed. And that's been a source of contention for many years with many men. But that was the difference. The attack was actually started the day before. And one of the other companies from another battalion was off to our right. They went through a woods that was supposedly cleared, and they got in there and found it was not cleared. And it was just kind of a fiasco from beginning to end. How they moved all that people in there without anybody knowing, we never knew.
Yeah, that was an intelligence breakdown probably, huh?
Well, sometimes military intelligence is an oxymoron.
Okay, so you are taken prisoner of war,
mm-hmm.
right, Bill Funke? So mm-hmm. tell us about that. I can't imagine.
Well, we had gotten back. We had been, I and another runner had been able to get most of the outposts back to the battalion area, which may have been wrong or right, but at the time that was the order to, and the final call when the major was, I think it was, just about 10 o'clock at night when he asked for permission to withdraw, and they told him that there would be ammunition up at, because we were down out of almost out of anything to fight with by then, that the ammunition would be up on a half track at midnight. And then another company would come to relieve us in the morning, and I happened to be standing right beside him when he made the message, and he said, send the ammunition, but let those other guys sleep. We won't be here.
Oh, my gosh.
He destroyed the radio, and that was it. And then when he could see what it was, he took it on himself to come out and to get the men who were near command post to the 17th to let them know that he felt it was time we had to give it up, because there was no reason. He felt we'd better live to fight another day than to die right then. So I give him credit for the courage enough to do what none of us wanted to do, but felt it was best for his men.
And what was his name?
His name was Major Logan.
Okay.
Major Logan. I communicate with his son every now and then. He lives up in Washington, and we discuss things. But I always thought he was a great commander.
Oh, Bill Funke, what an amazing
That's
story.
Cool. So you surrender, basically.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. We came out, and particularly our command post where the command officers were and where I was as their runner came out because they rolled a tank into the courtyard and had the gun sticking right in the building we were in. Mm-hmm.
And since this, and was it the SS that basically that you were surrendering
yes.
to?
Okay. Yes, they were SS.
And so how did they treat you then when they took you prisoner?
Well, you know, as my company commander said one time, they treated us as professionals. And I don't really know why. That's been a source of wonderment for a long time. Because, I mean, they could have just cleaned it up, but they started us marching and took us across the Rhine River in a flat-bottom boats, and we started marching into Germany. And, they never, we got, actually, when we went through the couple towns while we were walking, I can't recommend them, the town we walked for, it was near the Black Forest, but actually, German women would bring out water because we were dry, you know. Well, they knew it was, the jig was up anyhow because they knew it. Even though that one little attack they had succeeded, they knew the whole thing was up. So we were not beat or anything like that. But and then we were taken by train to near Stuttgart, and we were there for some time in a barracks-like thing. It was a stable. But then began the long trip to northern Germany to Stalag 11B. And
that was done via cattle car, is that right, Bill Funke?
That's right. And they used to call them 40 and 8, 40 men or 8 mules or something. But we were so packed in that we had to take turns sitting down or lying down because there wasn't room.
Was there any food and obviously probably no facilities either, huh?
Yeah, very little food. They would stop, and I don't even remember what we ate right now. I couldn't tell you. I don't remember. But again, it was the cold, except that we were packed so tight. I think maybe that was a blessing. Mm. But we were on that cattle cars for 3 nights and 4 days, or 4 nights and 3 days. I'm not too sure.
It was a while.
But we never got at them. Obviously, there was no sanitary facility, which made it very uncomfortable. Mm. And I think you asked about being afraid. I think the only time I was really afraid, and I think some of the other men were too, we were parked in a railroad yard one time, and we heard the air raid sirens go off, and we heard the planes come over. And we all thought they were going to bomb those railroad yards. We tried to break out of that thing. We tried to break things out of the only window was one little window up in one corner. And we tried to get that. We couldn't get through it. But we were just sitting ducks because the guards all ran to undercover. But I think that was the only time real fear struck.
Well, because you couldn't do anything about it. You, like you mentioned, you were sitting ducks. So.
No, couldn't do anything about it. And so that was a pretty miserable trip. Mm. And then we went to a town called Fallenbassel, which is up near Hamburg, up in the northern part of Germany. So, and then we stayed for the rest till we were liberated.
And so Bill Funke, when you get to Stalag, they basically, you get there, they open the cattle cars and take you out. What did it look like? What did you see?
Just a row of low, flat buildings, and just big open yards. A lot of fences, a lot of wire fences, and they took us into a compound, and we stayed in these little flat barracks-like things. We slept in the bunks, which were just wooden, and three bunks on each up. About 3 feet wide, as I recall, three and a half feet, and two men to a bunk. Now, you talk about companionship.
Two men in a bunk.
That,
and
that was it. That was it. And
three feet across.
One blanket for each bunk.
Yeah. Bill Funky, hang on with us. We're going to go to break, so we want to make sure that we get this entire story. So stick with us. It's World War II. You're now a prisoner of war. You've just gotten to Stalag 11B. And so let's go to break. When we come back, we'll continue the story from there because we want to hear the rest of the story about what it's like inside one of these camps. Stick with us. We're the AmeriChicks. We'll be right back.
And now, the Lens of Liberty. Here's Helen Creeble.
The government keeps sticking its spatula where it doesn't belong. Because a few people became sick from eating tainted hamburger years ago, the government urged more thorough cooking, and many states adopted regulations requiring restaurants to cook hamburgers at least medium well. The concern is understandable, but if we look at the issue through the lens of liberty, we might realize that giving the government power over the way we cook our food intrudes on our most basic freedoms. I happen to like my hamburgers medium rare, and so do millions of other Americans. As an informed citizen, it is my duty, not the government's, to know what risks I may be taking and to make the choices of a responsible adult. That is why Americans believe in limited government, because we believe ordinary people can govern themselves.
The Lens of Liberty is brought to you by the Vernon K. Creeble Foundation.
Today you need to have a great online and social media presence, and the best in the biz is Desi On Demand. The AmeriChicks Molly and Kim personally work with Brandon, the founder of Desi On Demand. Desi On Demand is instrumental with our video projects, Chick Chat, Exceptional Endeavors, and our World War II project. We most heartily endorse his creativity, innovation, dedication, and integrity. Brandon and his team bring all that to the table. Check out Desi On Demand's website at mydesi.com or call 303-359-1522 for more info, and be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you. Hey, if you like what you're hearing from the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, chances are your future clients do too. Let us help you promote your business and fatten up your wallet. To feature your business on the AmeriChicks program, email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. We feature the most topical news and intriguing guests every weekday during afternoon drive time, 5 to 6 p.m., while you and your clients are enjoying the program on your way home from work. So become a sponsor today by emailing the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. That's the AmeriChicks@gmail.com. Or visit us online at AmeriChicks.com. Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks Show. Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. It's World War II Day. We're excited to be telling the story of a prisoner of war who survived, Bill Funky. And before we get back to his story, though, we want to give a shout out and let you know one of our sponsors that we highly recommend is EvanYourITGuy.com. Check out EvanYourITGuy.com. They are a network of IT professionals ready to provide on-demand help for your computer needs anytime, 24/7. From the comfort of your own home. They will log into your computer remotely. You can watch them fix your computer. It's so convenient, so easy, so efficient, and then you're good to go. And if you call them right now, EvanYourITGuy.com, your first session with them is free. So do it. We highly recommend them.
Absolutely. We use them. They're marvelous.
Marvelous. So back to our World War II story. So Bill Funky has been telling the story. He served in Company A of the 17th Armored Infantry Battalion of the 12th Armored Division and during the Second World War. At one point, his group was captured. He was taken to Stalag 11B, and that was what we hear one of the worst prisoner of war camps in Germany. And so before we went to break, Bill, you were telling us about the bunk beds that were just sheets of plywood measured 3 feet wide and two men to a bed. It had to be a pretty uncomfortable situation, but let's continue on from there. What else was it like living in this camp?
Well, you lived and slept in your clothes, and I recall them being cleaned only once. I mean, it took us to a shower. I think we had one shower in the three months we were there, and they cleaned the clothes while you were, so that was just once, which is a long time. The smell was pretty bad.
Yeah.
But the sleeping, you had, if you wanted to turn over, you woke up your bunk partner, and so you could turn together. Mm. But, and then the eating, was not much. It was usually a bowl of rutabaga soup, and I can't look a rutabaga in the eye anymore to this day. But and a little square of black bread, and then some tea, certain time of day, I don't recall. But the bread is kind of an interesting thing. I got a recipe only about 5-6 years ago from a man who found it in Germany. The recipe for the bread for the prison of war camps had an interesting ingredient in it called tree flour. And tree flour is sawdust. So it's part sawdust, so you could imagine the taste that went there. But
tree flour sounds a little bit better than sawdust, you know it?
That's good marketing right there.
Yes, it does. But there was really very much nothing to do except talk. Stalag 11B was interesting, and they considered one of the worst because it contained a lot of Russian prisoners, a lot of them Mongolia and India and just all over the world. And those poor people were worse off than we were, particularly the Russians. They just died with flies. As a matter of fact, our bunk was right near a brick building we called the Dead House, and every day the dead wagon would come with the bodies from the Russian place, and they'd just stack them in that brick building. We were not quite that bad off, but they never really bothered us. The war was coming to a close, and they knew it. And I think that's part of the thing. The only violence I ever saw, I never saw violence against an American or British troop who was in there, but once they told us if we didn't get back from the fence, they would shoot us, so they shot a Russian standing near us instead, which was shaking, so we kind of bit a little more careful then. But we did get a little bold. We'd go into different compounds. I know a friend of mine and I would go sneak under a wire into the Indian compound from India and talk to them because they spoke good English. And I learned a lot of history because I asked one of these Indians one time, I said, why did your country accept the Japanese so readily? And he said, because at that time an enemy was a friend. Enemy of an enemy was a friend. So I learned a little more about history than I ever knew. But the real telling thing, I thought, was when we got into a compound with a young Russian engineer who spoke good English, had been a builder and designer of dams. And we talked to him, and just before we were liberated, I mentioned to him, I said, well, you're going to be happy to get out of here and on your way to go home. And he said, no, I can't go home because I would be killed before I get far. And I said, why would you? You're an engineer. You did all this for your country. And he said, I know too much. And so I got a little history lesson on the Soviet Republic right from that. Uh-huh. And so there were some interesting things that you could do because it was just boredom mainly.
Well, and so, Bill Funke, everybody kind of knew the war was coming to an end, that the Allies were going to win. What was it like the day that the camp was liberated?
It was like Hollywood. Well, a tank broke down the door and happened to be the British 6th Army, I believe it was. It was British anyhow. And the tank broke down, and one of the British GIs was on the bank, back of the tank, saying, stay put, don't try to get out, don't roam around. He said, we'll have you out in 3 or 4 days. You'll just get in our way. So just stay where we were, and we'll bring you in food. Instead, when they brought in so much food, some guys got sick
from
eating incorrectly. And it wasn't until about, 10 years ago that I knew that that British GI telling us what to do was General Montgomery.
Yeah, I guess he was a British GI, huh? So
yeah, the British GI.
Bill Funke, go ahead.
But we knew it was coming in because the planes would fly over, and, of course, it was just a continual parade day and night. of British bombers by night and American bombers by day. And they would drop leaflets, and they'd say the same things. Stay put. Don't bother. We'll be there soon. And so we knew it was coming.
Bill Funke, I'm curious, because the German soldiers at this point that were in the camp knew that you were about to be liberated. So did they act any differently, or how did they act?
No, they didn't, but a lot of them left.
Okay.
A lot of them, I don't know if they deserted their post or what, but there weren't any around when the liberation came. So I suspect they took off as fast as they could.
Okay.
Yeah. Bill, we had the one interesting thing was we were in the camp when President Roosevelt died, and the camp commander, who I look back now, reminded me an awful lot of like Colonel Klink of MASH. And he was the one that brought us the news that the president had died. That's all he said, and then he left. But we never saw him again, so I suspect he left too.
Interesting. So, Bill Funke, we are just about out of time. When you came back to the United States, you got married, and you were a music teacher for many years.
I was.
And touched many students' lives over the years. And I think there's a special place in heaven for music teachers.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
But in Brad Hoop's book, Reflections of Our Gentle Warriors, we have just a couple of minutes. There's a story that you tell about a former student who was a POW in the Vietnam War. Do you mind sharing that with our listeners?
Oh, yes. That was one of the strange things. I had a very, very good student who went to Vietnam, and while he was there, he kind of went the trip like a lot of them, you know, the drug thing and this and that. And he came back, and he was so empowered with the idea of the POWs that were still there and releasing the POWs. And he was talking to me one day, and he wasn't doing well in school. It was eating him up, you know. And I said, you know, Bill, I said, I wish that in my heart, I say, yes, there are prisoners there. We can get out. But my brain tells me no. Because every war, there are men who stay where they are. I don't understand it, but they do. I mean, it's a fact that they do. And so I said, I wish you could just put this back some way and really try to get rid of it and get on with your life. And he said, well, you know, he said, we have a thing called survivor's guilt. And something inside me triggered, and I spoke to this young man like I had never spoken to a student. I said, Bill, don't you ever say that word to me as long as you live. Anytime you see me, don't ever dare say that word. I said, you didn't know it, that I and a lot of other people, you didn't invent the word survivor's guilt. I said, when I was on that podium directing the choir, sometime during that hour, every day, as long as you knew me, someday my mind was back in Herlesheim and the prison camp, but particularly Herlesheim, saying, what could I have done different to make a difference? So don't tell me about that. He was really taken aback, and I never saw him. But I did see his parents, and I said, I'd like to get a hold of Bill and apologize, because I think I know I owe him an apology. And they said, no, you don't, because he told us about that. And we think it was that one incident that started him on the right track, moving around. And I've heard since he's been very successful. So that was one good thing, that quick spoken word that you regretted later, you found out worked for him.
Well, it was spoken in honesty and in love. And Bill Funke, we are out of town. I, on behalf of Molly and I, it is just an honor to have gotten to do this interview with you today. We just are very, very grateful for that.
We are. Thank you so much, Bill Funke. And, you know, I think a lot of people...
Do you have a half a minute?
Yes.
We do.
I would say something in respect to the men who are serving us now. I think we had it easy. We knew who the enemy was, and we knew where they were. These poor men don't know from time to time who they're dealing with. Somebody who may be sitting at lunch with them may be the one that's after them. And so I think they face a different set of problems than we did. So I feel for them, and I stand in awe of what they're doing. Oh. I stand in awe of what you people are doing, too.
Well, Bill Funke, thank you so much. This is the AmeriChicks. It's our World War II project, and that's our story with Bill Funke, World War II veteran. Thank you so much. We'll be back here next
time. Same place.